This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about therapy with repeat guest Elena Gabrielle. And I say repeat guest in that I've interviewed her before on our other show, Dating Games. Actually, she's the first person to ever appear on that show twice. So there's a hint at what a good guest she could be. And we got talking about therapy off air and how much we appreciate it and her experiences around it. So it seemed like the perfect time to get her over on Mental as well. So with that all said, we've got some stats to kick us off on this theme. First, we've got some from the NHS in relation to their IAPT program, which is short for Improving Access to Psychological Therapies, and is essentially a self-referral process. Medical professionals can also refer you into it, but it's a newer scheme in order to make it more efficient, people accessing therapy. And in particular, it's so exciting that it has that self-referral element. So you can refer when you feel like you need therapy. If you perhaps listen to the episode and feel like it's time for you to give it a go, you can just look that up and self-refer without the need for getting a diagnosis or an appointment with a GP first. You can just go into that yourself. And so the stats we've got here are for January 2021, a time when things were very tough with the pandemic, a very tough time of year for a lot of people, January anyway. And so the referrals for that month were 131,621. And of those, 92.7% of the referrals resulted in treatment starting within 6 weeks. That's really positive and certainly much higher than what existed before the IAPT program. And with those referrals, there was an average 7.8 sessions of treatment per referral, which is an interesting number given that they start from 6 sessions by default, and you can be given more depending on the initial assessment, or potentially the counsellor can ask their management essentially if they can give you a few extra. And so that's really positive to see that even though we think of maybe people that might drop out after a few sessions, or people that may even drop out before having any sessions at all, even with that taken into account, the average number of sessions is still higher than that 6. And of those as well, interestingly, 37,213 were internet-enabled therapy sessions. So the vast majority were in person.
Yes, I think that's, wow. I mean, there's loads to consider, but I think that last point that you've just made is really interesting, because I hear so many different people with so many views about face-to-face or online therapy, and there's been so much research lately, of course, about it. But like with everything that we talk about, like having the option available and it being put at its, you know, most challenging time and really being tested has been great, because maybe having both options and that agility around it just suits everybody differently. And I know even with me, you know, I would personally prefer face-to-face, but then that's because I think I prefer everything face-to-face, if I'm totally honest. Like, I'm a bit over everything being online. You and I have gone online since the pandemic, but then obviously now with your move to Ireland, that's just the way that it goes, and then these situations are fine. But there are times when just having that face-to-face moment, just to cut out some of those, oh, have you finished speaking yet? Okay, now I'll start talking. Oh, I'm interrupting you. Oh, I'm not, you know? And those, that body language and the connection you get through that, I find to be, you know, really important. That's personal choice. And then also, you know, with some of those stats, I'd love therapy to reach so many more people and more people to be aware of it, and just to be open to the fact that you don't have to be ill to go and seek therapy. Like, that's one of the biggest things, the misconception is about it. Like, why, what's the matter? So much out there and different opportunities to see different therapies in different settings for different reasons. I just think I wish more people would. But to hear that that 92% of that figure that you talked about, the 131,000 or and a half referrals to talking therapy, that's a high percentage though, at least, of those who have been referred that have actually had something started within 6 weeks. And again, when we break it down, 6 weeks is a long time when if you're in crisis, not maybe so much if you can manage and know that there's some light at the end of the tunnel. But a good friend of mine the other day contacted Mind in Birmingham, and within a week she had an appointment. In fact, her appointment's tomorrow. And I just thought that was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, within 24 hours, there was a phone call to assess her needs and how what was happening for her. And within a week, which is tomorrow, she's got her first session. Amazing, I thought.
Oh, for sure. And that's the usual timescale if you were going privately. If you were paying it out of pocket, you would expect that kind of speed. So the fact that you're getting that from a charity, and that's something that I'd always recommend to people of looking at your options. Because there are often local services and charities that do provide those additional options that may be able to get you in quicker, or may have what's becoming increasingly common is sliding scale therapy. So a lot of private therapists do that, a lot of charities do that to help sort of balance out the cost, where they'll assess your income, or sometimes they'll just do it off, give a donation of an amount that feels affordable for you. And so that can actually be surprisingly flexible of paying a fraction of what you normally would. Equally, student rates are often available as well. And so there are more options out there, and the IAP service is a really great free option. And so I agree, it's really great to see that it's getting there, and also that people's mentalities are shifting, because I agree, it's a big part of it. And actually looking at some stats from the Mental Health Foundation that actually surprised us. So, you know, the IAP service is doing well. And yet sometimes you look at how many people might be hesitant of going for support, who may need it. And those stats can be quite shocking. And so that might be some of the factor in these stats I'll read here. So 1 in 8 people in England, it's 12.1% to be exact, receive mental health treatment, with 10.4% of those people receiving medication, 3% receiving psychological therapy. And so I found that interesting, because of course that's looking at the general population. So not, you know, specifically people that might have a diagnosis or might have gone to the GP with a specific concern, but the population generally. But even still, we found that very low, 12.1%. And these are pre-pandemic figures, I should say. But even still, you know, I hope that that is on the rise. But those the more recent data is still being gathered. And 3% receiving psychological therapy. Again, that might be surprising to some people, the gap between the amount of people receiving medication and therapy. I think a big part of that is that therapy tends to be more time-limited, less open-ended in terms of the NHS options than medication can be. And people are more commonly going in and out of therapy themselves, depending on how they feel. But even still, 3%, we'd love to see that get so much larger, including, for me, I know it's a sign when I'm doing okay, when I'm talking less about mental illness to my counsellor and more about, oh, I went on an awkward date and I want to tell you about it.
Yeah.
You know, and it does help to get that perspective and get that off your chest.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because with those figures, you just think why, and we know why, and there's so much cost involved. But, you know, medication is not cheap or free either, but we seem to willingly give it out. It frustrates me a little bit. I just wish that if you're having, here's the medication and here's your therapy sessions, like, take them together.
I hear what you're saying. It's one of those complicated things, right, that varies so much from person to person. And sometimes people need the medication to get to a level of stability where therapy will be helpful, or where they'll even feel stable enough to delve into that level of feelings of stuff that they may have pushed down for a long time. But what I will say is there's certainly a strange disparity between, you know, if you couldn't get your medication right away or pretty quickly, people would really kick off about that because it's so unusual. And yet there is a certain norm to, okay, you go on the waiting list for therapy, and how wonderful it would be to get to a point where that isn't the case. A lot of that is to do with funding. Yeah, therapy costs more than drugs do.
I know, and it's, you know, it just worries me all the time, because The bottom line is I'm so pro-therapy, as everybody can probably tell, and medication. And as Bobby, you absolutely correctly pointed out that depending on your level of illness or what you're going through in that time, sometimes medication is what you need very quickly just to kind of stabilize you. So, you know, absolutely, that would be the right thing to do if you feel that you are at a point of perhaps crisis or even a little less than crisis, but just really struggling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think where we sit within the mental health field, we're always going to be here to advocate, go get the support, because we see how often the stigma stops people from even getting the support. And then, you know, as much as we can complain about, absolutely, there are problems with waiting lists, particularly specific therapies, mm-hmm. you know, the waiting list can be astronomical for certain kinds, but it's still not as long a waiting list as if you never got referred in the first place. You know, then that it's not without its challenges, but I'm always, like you, going to advocate for get the support, and the support can be really incredible. And something that came up actually with the episode with Eleanor was her talking about, you know, encouraging friends to go. And so even though it took her a while to go to therapy, as it did for me, you know, once you've done that and you see the benefits for yourself, then you want everyone in on it. And, you know, you can, as much as you can be a cheerleader, it's easier said than done. And so one thing I missed saying in the episode, so I'll say now, is that one of the biggest things I've found has made a difference in my own friend groups and around family is just talking about it, just normalizing the conversation. And so, you know, if we're having a conversation about something, I won't hold back from saying, oh yeah, no, I talked about this with my therapist the other day and she made this great point, or I was saying this to her. It took a little while for that to feel normal for me to bring that up. But actually now it's so lovely to see that some people that might have raised an eyebrow and be like, oh, like you said, be like, oh, what did you go to her for? How did that start? You know, who might have been a bit like, oh, that's a thing to bring up right there. And now just really used to it. And so then if anyone's thinking of getting therapy in my friend group, well, they already know. They already know that I've got a great person they might ask for the details of, or I will always offer to say to a friend, we'll research it together. We'll look at options available locally to you. And sometimes that bit of showing up, normalizing the conversation and being somewhere that can demystify the process can make a world of difference, more than even the best meaning encouragement of, oh, you should really nudge. You know, we're all on a different time scale.
Yeah, well, you certainly did with me. And like you said, I think that's such a key point, the normalization of it, which you've always done, you know, like they do in the States. Like we said, they just talk all day about my therapist. But then again, you know, we're being a bit blinded, because those people that I hear talk about my therapist, not all, but most, are probably famous people. Let's be honest, they're probably people of some kind of power that I'm actually even accessing online or on TV or through interviews. They're not the day-to-day, generally normal people like me or whatever. Although we, you know, we do know that it's much more common there. I guess how common it is for, you know, your day-to-day Joanne blogs to talk about it might not be as still as much as it is there. Because even there are some Brits out here, some celebrities and stuff, and you know, who do talk about it. So I think it's when, again, it's that whole stigma thing of when you've got some kind of power or influence on others, or you know people look up to you, as hard as it can be, I think there's something in being able to share that you see a therapist and feeling okay with that, because you've got people that you know that you're influencing and inspire, who are inspired by you. So to share some of that truth, I mean, like, look at Adele at the moment. She's just been so open, interviews all over the place about what she's been through with her mental health in the last couple of years. And it does give you some faith when these are people that you may, like, as I said, look up to or feel inspired by, who talk openly about that. So, yeah, you keep doing that and I will do too.
Yeah, it's so wonderful to see this kind of progress. And, yeah, the conversation's becoming normalised. And I'd, like, that's where I'm at now, where my counsellor is a member of the cast of my life, you know, someone that gets mentioned in the same way I might mention seeing my parents or catching up with a friend. And I think that's a really lovely place to be for me as well in terms of my recovery, to feel that I can be open about things I'm working on. And it was lovely talking to Eleanor about it, because you're right about the stigma. Just like we see when you might talk about your own mental health or disclose a particular condition you have experience of, then so often people jump on that. And if it's not them, it's, oh, my cousin also has depression. And people are often more ready for the conversation just if they get that sort of indication that it's a safe space to talk. And exactly the same thing. You know, me and Eleanor was there chatting off air, being like, oh, what's your cancer like? Oh, cool. Mine's this. How long have you been going? Like, it becomes then a really nice thing to have in common and to talk about.
Yeah. So, and I also think, sorry to interrupt you, but my last point on that is something that's been going on in my world recently is that, you know, it's also useful, even if you want to go to support somebody close to you who is experiencing poor mental health, or because it's not just always when thing, you know, anything's going on for yourself, but we know that, again, there's support out there for families when people are perhaps dying from physical illness or really struggling. There's support out there to talk that through. And I think it's the same thing when we think about mental health. I know it can be a really, really difficult time to support somebody, especially when it's somebody very close to you. And I probably feel that sometimes for my friends and family who... So I think, yeah, also bear that in mind, that that support, as the supporter, as the carer, is also out there, and you can use therapy for that too.
Oh, no, great point. And I definitely do that. You know, often I will start off a session talking about I'm worried about a particular friend, and that's my emotions, but it's also theirs. And you are having someone to talk to who has probably dealt with all kinds of issues under the sun. You know, it won't be the first time they've heard about whatever your friend is going through. And so they may be in a really great position to advise you if you've not dealt with something before. So, yeah, totally agree. And so it was really lovely to catch up with Eleanor and hear about this part of her life. And also we talk a little bit about her being a comedian and how she finds the balance between being open about her own struggles and then also, you know, finding the funny without undermining her own lived experience, you know, that difference between laughing together perhaps and laughing at and making jokes of things that can be really difficult. And so, yeah, that was really interesting to me as a comedy nerd, but I think there's something we can all learn about how we have conversations in our own lives and find ways to be honest, even when, you know, sometimes people do want particular emotions from us and we can tell. And so, yeah, that was very powerful. So with all that said, we'll get into the episode with Eleanor in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
We're delighted to be partnering again with Wild, the natural deodorant company whose products we've been using for over a year now.
I've tried a lot of options previously, but this is a sustainable deodorant that really works and smells brilliant at the same time.
Yeah, you just buy one aluminium case that lasts a lifetime and holds biodegradable deodorant refills. Their unisex scents are so distinctive and include regular limited edition specials, which I love.
Mm-hmm. For example, I'm currently using the Wild Strawberry one, which I think was one of the summer scents, and it smells so yummy that I do smell my pits after using it sometimes.
Most of us stick with one boring deodorant for life. I certainly did before I knew about Wild. Even if it isn't the best fit for us, this one has 100% satisfaction guarantee, so is as risk-free as life gets. Plus, as one of our listeners, you'll get 20% off your first order by using the code MENTAL20, which I must say my friend has been asking me for since I introduced her to Wild, because she's got a young daughter who has started using deodorant. So loved the fact that there was a natural deodorant rather than just, you know, an off the shelf one that didn't have any benefits for the environment or that wasn't natural on her skin, because she's only 10, the little girl. Mm-hmm. So amazing.
Yes, I love that. And we love this brand so much. You can join us in going wild for natural deodorant as well at wearewild.com with that code MENTAL20 at the checkout. It's sustainable, effective, discounted, safe for 10-year-olds, and linked in the episode description.
This is a limited time offer, however, so get wild for your picks today.
I make up most of these taglines. And one day a company will take one on, and that's how we know we've won at advertising. But yeah love yeah. it. Love wild, go get it.
Hi, my name is Elena Gabriel, and this is a story that happened to me when I was around 17 years old. I grew up in a small town, like a rural town outside of Melbourne in Victoria, Australia, and I was always in and out of hospital, not me, but I was always in and out of hospitals for people who were dying or people who were sick when I was growing up. And one of my earliest memories was my grandfather. He was a quadriplegic. He fell off a haystack on our farm and was in a wheelchair for the last few years of his life. Because of that, I was also very, I want to say, mollycoddled as a child. My parents, whenever I was sick or anything like that, they would get overprotective, or if I wasn't allowed to have a trampoline or a horse because I might, God forbid, fall off and break my neck. So I always had this feeling of, you know, not being sick. And then my grandfather was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. That's the latest cancer, when I was around 10 years old. So a lot of that, I was in and out of hospital with him with chemo. And so I was always around it. And I always had this fear that I was sick or that I was going to get cancer because everyone like around me was getting really sick. So that was always something that was developed in conditioned in me at an early age. And so when I was 17, I'd always heard about needle stick injuries, which around the time, which was probably what, in the early 2000s, there was a lot of kind of needles found on beaches and people and on trams and on trains, and people would, you know, accidentally prick themselves and then get diagnosed with HIV or hepatitis or any other illness. And so when I was 17, I had a school excursion in Melbourne. So it was outside of my hometown, and I was sitting on a tram, and I felt like something on my leg, and I was like, "Ooh, I don't know what that is, but it kind of hurt." And I was like, "That's weird." It felt like a bit of a prick and didn't think anything of it. But then that night I got home and I started thinking about it, and I was like, "Oh my God." And I looked on the back of my leg and there was like a little red mark, and I got so paranoid, and I created this scene in my mind that I had sat on a syringe, and I didn't tell anyone for weeks, and I kept this inside. I was, you know, 17 at school, and I just kept thinking about like, oh, I'm going to get HIV and I'm going to die. And I'm like, I started planning my funeral. I started all this kind of crazy stuff now when I think back on it. So I wrote a letter to my mum, and it was, I can't even imagine what my mum was thinking when she got that letter, because it was basically like, "Hey mum, I'm going to die. So this is like, I'm okay with it. Like, this is what I've planned for the funeral, like blah, 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 blah." Really intense stuff. And I left it for her. She went to work early, and then I was kind of waiting for her message. And I got up and I had a message from her, and she was like, "Call me." So I called her and I just broke down, and I was like, "Mom, I think this happened, blah, blah, blah." So we went straight to the doctor. I got all the tests done. They were all fine. We had to wait another 3 months just in case. And everything was fine. But I think from then on, that was kind of the moment where I started also going, the doctor also recommended that I go and see a psychologist and sort of to address a lot of the anxiety that I was having, you know, which obviously started from this huge catastrophizing, which is also what I've been diagnosed as having, is probably also why I do the job that I do as well. I'm very dramatic. And that sort of started me on my therapy and into taking antidepressants for a few years as well, just to sort of get me through kind of school and university. And then, yeah, and then that's my little story into how I kind of got diagnosed and how I am who I am today, I think.
Yeah. You look unsure, but no, that was very articulate.
It's so weird because I was just telling you, like, I've never told that story to anyone before. I think only like a handful of friends know it, and it's something that I don't really talk about much. So it's still very like weird and emotional for me to sort of say that out loud in front of people and on a podcast. But it's good because it's about mental health, and this is why we need to talk about stuff like this.
Absolutely. And this is one of the fascinating things, that I can know people and still never make any assumptions about their background or what kind of story they might tell me like that, because we just have such a complex tapestry, each of us, when it comes to our mental health. And so I'm very grateful for you sharing that. And no, I can totally see how terrifying that would have been, and how you built it up in your head. And like you said, God knows what your mum must have thought. I think if I read a letter like that, I'd assume someone was suicidal.
Yeah, yeah. And it was, it's one of those things where, you know, I grew up so scared of death as well, because it's like I grew up with a lot of anxiety. I still even remember being like 5 or 6 years old, and it was around the time that they were doing nuclear bomb testing in like the Pacific Ocean. And like, I just remember like hearing that on the news and being like a 5 year old and being like, oh my God, like we're all going to die. They're going to drop bombs. And the same thing, that was just kind of my life. And I think that was a lot to do with a lot of tragedy that happened around in our family at such a young age. Like there was a lot of people, like my grandmother, she died before I was born because she had cancer, but she didn't tell anyone about it because my brother was born. And so she had this, it's that generation where it's like, I don't want to make waves. I don't want to like, you know, disrupt everyone because I'm sick. And I grew up with that. So every time I had a headache, my mum was like, oh my God, are you okay? Like, whoa, that kind of stuff. And I see now how that was kind of very conditioned in me early to be just always conscious about being sick or being, you know, a very hypochondriac in a sense, which I mean, maybe saves my life sometimes because I'm always like, oh, I've got to go to the doctor. This isn't right. But also it does manifest in a way that was quite detrimental and really caused me a lot of anxiety growing up and stuff as well. So my mental health has been a very tumultuous kind of thing, but you know, I'm good now. I do my therapy and I know why I am the way that I am, which is the best thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found that at times quite frustrating with my own experiences, where you do the work to figure out some of these elements of who you are and what your kind of patterns have been in terms of your mental health. And so often they can be things like this where you can see the clear through line. You can be like, okay, well, I was around a lot of anxiety around health. I was around a lot of people getting very ill, which would confirm the need for that anxiety seemingly. And then you can almost feel self-conscious of like, oh, this feels too simple. You know, that how have Definitely. I internalized this when it's so obvious? But of course, it's obvious in hindsight.
Of course. And when you've done the work and all that kind of stuff. But I think the real interesting for me, what I've found, you know, particularly, I guess, with my mental health and I know probably with others as well, that it always stems from like one thing. Like it's always like, you know, anxiety. Like anxiety for me is my main kind of, you know, mental health, I don't know, like the thing that is always at the cause and the root cause of everything that has been on my journey. So I think when I've gone into depression, it's been because of anxiety, or, you know, when I was really catastrophizing and in this kind of very hypochondriac kind of mentality, psychosomatic mentality, it was because I was anxious. And then when I was in my early 20s, I had anorexia for many years, but that also stemmed from anxiety as well and being very controlling. And, you know, it's funny coming from someone who was like catastrophizing and, oh, I don't want to die, and I'm always going to the doctors and doing that, to then it sort of morphing into an eating disorder, which is kind of like you are killing yourself in a way. So it's a very interesting thing of how the mind can just play out different mental health scenarios just from one kind of root cause, which I've always found really interesting. And I'm always aware of now when something else is happening in my life, I'm like, okay, why am I going into this? Is it because I'm anxious about something, or is that the main reason? It's a tapestry, like you said earlier. It's like it very much is, and it's a very interesting experience to do therapy and to see it, you know, with like without, I don't know, I don't want to say without rose-colored glasses, but just to see it so clearly and to recognize the patterns and how much that helps so much, so much.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the examples you've reminded me of is around the experience of triggers. And I think this is something that maybe is kind of used at times in such a colloquial way that people don't take it seriously. And it's kind of tricky because fundamentally, when someone is triggered in terms of their mental health, it's to do with a reaction that is disproportionate to the situation, but is not disproportionate to the context of your background and certain things that this experience may link to. So an example I can share around that is a great example of this, because the situation itself shouldn't have been nearly as stressful as I found it. And that is, I had a particular workplace where when we'd have our lunch break, it was somewhere that served food and we could have food on our lunch break for free. and there was a staff room, but there was also a downstairs bar that wasn't always used. And so sometimes we'd sit in the downstairs bar and it was a little bit plusher and we felt a bit like we were real customers and not people that had like 20 minutes to quickly scoff down some food and get back out there. And I think I'd got my food before everyone else. And I said, should we go downstairs again today? I know it's open. I know it's empty or whatever. And everyone seemed to agree. And so I headed down first and no one joined me. And so I was there for 20 minutes and I sort of committed to it then because I was like, well, I'm eating my food and I've got a limited time for this break. So I'm just going to stay here and hopefully they join me. And the longer I was there sat on my own, the more those feelings ramped up. And my mind was just kind of whirring with this feeling of abandonment, really. I said rejection earlier. Abandonment is really what's at the core of this. And then I had to get back to the shift and continue with my work. And it turned out to be perfectly innocent that somebody else in that group wanted to stay upstairs and they were already upstairs. So they just stayed with her and assumed that I would realise and just appear back in the next few minutes. And so that situation itself, I can totally see. But the feelings I was in at the time were so intense that then for the rest of my shift, I was really on edge and stressed and very in my head and disconnected. And I just had to really struggle to behave normally around the others because I'd been really upset by it. But I'd been upset because it linked to stuff for me to do with my past. And for whatever reason, that situation just really got to me. But it was it wasn't something I could obviously hold against them. It wasn't something I could really explain in the middle of my workday.
No, true. And I think like that, like the abandonment and like rejection, I think that's a very, very, very common thing with mental health is like abandonment issues are so huge, like for a lot of people. Like that's why I think even in this past like 18 months, nearly 2 years, it's been hard for a lot of people who don't know how to be lonely and or don't know how to be alone. I don't want to say how to be lonely, but how to be alone, because it is to feel that fear of abandonment is like the worst thing. Like no one wants to be lonely. That's why people, you know, fall in love with the wrong people or in relationships because they just don't want to be alone. You know, and I think that's also why a lot of us keep very busy. And for me, like I was always through my mental health kind of history, it was always like, just keep busy because as soon as you stop, that's when you start to feel all of the feelings and when you don't have something that's kind of driving you. So it's this balance of kind of trying to not overwork yourself and kind of like, you know, suppress all these feelings of you know, not knowing how to be alone or whatever, and also, you know, balancing your kind of work-life balance as well. For you, do you find most people that you talk to maybe on this podcast, I think, is there a lot of like abandonment or like rejection is kind of the common theme along a lot of people? I find a lot of my friends feel like a little bit the same, I think, in terms of being lonely or they find it very difficult.
I think it's very common. And also it links for a lot of people when it comes to stigma, because that is one of the big fears that can come from being open about your mental health of how might I be shunned, whether that's to do with family, society, friends. And so I think probably all of us have some level of that. You know, I think you would have to try, I don't know, I think you would have to have a whole series of coincidences and lucky circumstances to grow up and feel you can be yourself and you can be open about all the ways you are who you are and not think that any part of that might be judged or lead to some kind of social
backlash. Totally. I think it also comes back to like being in high school or things like that where you want to be accepted. And I think acceptance is like a huge part of being human because we are such like social beings where we need that from people. And I don't know about you, but when I'm alone, sometimes it's not good because I need to be around people. Like I'm particularly someone who gets my energy from being around other people. Again, probably why I do the job that I do. Like I love that. I love feeling people's energy. And that sort of fills my battery. But then I know people who are just so happy to not be around people at all, and that fills their battery. And so I'm like, but I look at them and I'm like, how are you not depressed? How do you just like, because for me, it's just such a weird kind of thing. But I think being around other people, I think, is very special. And I think we've kind of realized that. I mean, I have in the last 18 months of not being able to see my family and not really, you know, being a single woman in an apartment without anyone else here, without a dog or without anything. It's kind of, you know, it's really, really important to have not a lot of friends, but just the people that you know that you can always call. And I think that those friends are always going to be there when you are not healthy mentally. They're like the people that you need to have around, kind of, and stuff.
Yeah. I think that's so true, and I'm relating to a lot of what you're saying, particularly the filling your life with work as a way to be busy and distracted. Like so many of the things we've mentioned already, I found through going to therapy myself, the awareness is so often the first step, that if we can realise these things that we're articulating now, that makes such a difference even before you do any further work. Like, that's work in itself. And so the example I gave around abandonment, being able to at least know in that situation what was going on meant that I could still get through the rest of the shift and not feel a panic of what the fuck am I feeling like this for? And, you know, having only that situation to attribute the feelings to, who knows how I might have reacted worse. And so whilst it didn't solve it at the time, it did mean I've got to do a lot more work on that since. And so, you know, then when these things come up, that's sort of like a conversation I have often with people, where there can be this trap of thinking that mental health is something that you get fixed on. And actually it's like, no, you, in many ways, you kind of get deeper into some elements of it in terms of your understanding.
Mm.
And in other ways, your emotions are a lot easier to deal with because of that.
Yeah.
And so is it possible that I'll be triggered in a similar way again? Yes, but I don't think the level of the emotions will be anything like that. And I'll certainly each time know how to handle it better.
Definitely. And I think it's interesting, like you say, about acceptance, because I think that is a huge part of therapy and going through it. Like, awareness and acceptance is a huge, huge part of it. I mean, the best therapy I ever did was a few years ago, and I'm kicking myself that I didn't finish it, but I ended up moving to Europe in the middle of it. But it was a really different kind of therapy, because when I was diagnosed with like catastrophizing in my anxiety when I was 17 after that incident, they wanted me to go to therapy. And in Australia, like, you get, I think it's 8 free sessions of psychological sessions every year. It's part of like our NHS. And so I went to one, and I just it was all the CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which for me as a like 17, 18 year old, I was like, I don't get this. I don't like it. It's too formulaic. It's too, I don't know. I hated it. And I did about 4 sessions, and I was like, I can't, like, this isn't for me. I hate therapy. And then about 6 or 7 years later, when I'd sort of just gotten out of kind of like the worst part of my anorexia and was coming out of it and sort of living again. And I was like, okay, I feel good. I'm going to go back to therapy and I'm going to try it again. And I found this guy, he was American psychologist living in Melbourne. And he did this kind of therapy, which was it was pretty intense, but it was kind of like where they ask you, he's like, okay, what don't you, like, first session we walked in, he's like, all right, what don't you like about yourself? And I was like, oh, okay. And so you just start listing. I was like, you know, he's like, what, do you think you're not smart? Do you think you're fat? Do you think you're ugly? Like, and he was like, he's like going on this sort of stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, all right, I think I'm this. And I was like, I must've said like, oh yeah, I don't think I'm very intelligent. He's like, okay, why? Why don't you think you're very smart? And I'm like, I don't know, and so you started going really deep into like this stuff. He's like, rate yourself out of 10. Like, where are you from 1 to 10 on the how smart do you think you are? And I'm like, oh, I'm about like, I think I'm a 7. And he's like, okay, then why aren't you an 8? Why aren't you a 9? Why aren't you a 10? And I was like, but he was asking me, not rhetorically, like, he was asking, why aren't you this? I was like, oh, because I didn't study very much in school. Why? Oh, because I was like, and he kept asking that question, and you started getting really deep into these reasons as to why you didn't like feel good about yourself. And then you'd kind of walk out, and then he was like, then the next part is acceptance, where it's just kind of like, okay, cool. I'm a 7 out of 10. I'm not that smart, but I'm fine with that because I have all these other things on in my life. And it was a really interesting, it was better for me. I find I'm very structured, like I said, with cognitive behavioral therapy, it was too structured. But I think for me, I like to kind of have a lot more, I don't know, rational thought when I'm going through my brain. Like, if I have an anxiety attack or anything like that, I kind of go, why am I feeling this way? And so for me, that kind of therapy was amazing. And it really went deep, and it was like about everything. And I think when I sort of hit that therapy, I was like, oh, okay, that made me way more aware of my behavior and everything like that. And then now when I'm back into doing therapy now, like, and I've been, I mentioned this the other day, which I've been doing therapy pretty much every week for nearly a year now, and it's been amazing. And I went into that because of after an abusive relationship. So I, and but that's a very different therapy as well, but it's more conversational and kind of, you know, talking over things a lot more, which has also been very good too. So I think there's a lot of people who are anti-therapy, but I think you just have to find the right person and you have to find the right formula of therapy that works for you.
Oh, for sure, because it sounds so wonderful that you got that experience from the American guy that you mentioned. But even you describing it, I know that wouldn't get on with me. Because I think someone that is very active and questioning my kind of viewpoint and my outlook on the world when I've just met them, I think my response would be to be combative back and be like, well, how do you know that's the right question to ask? Like, I think I would do the same back to him. And and so it really does vary. And I have a counsellor now that I've been with for 4 years. And I went privately, ultimately. I knew that I needed long-term. And I get to, you know, one of the benefits of that, of course, I think it should be much more accessible, but she does things like sliding scale therapy. So she does have, you know, for people that are students, for example, she'll have different rates she can potentially offer. But one of the benefits of that, that private option, is you get to have so much choice over who you go to. And I think for me, that was massive. I think it's massive for everyone, but I think I went in with that awareness, at least, of ultimately it's a relationship and you need to get on with this person, and they need to be a kind of safe space for you in their presence. It, oftentimes we're in therapy because we haven't had that safe space elsewhere, or we're in therapy to talk about people in our life that we wish would go to therapy but wouldn't.
Yep. Exactly. And I think that that's a really valid point, because I think there also have been times in my life where I think I've used my friends as psychologists, even though they're not psychologists. And I think it's a really good point to bring up that we shouldn't be using our friends and family as, you know, therapists in a sense. Like, I think it's easy to do sometimes, you know, when things aren't going right in your life or blah, 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 or you want to talk about stuff. It's like, there is a time and a place for it. And I think I realized that, particularly in this toxic relationship, because I was just using all my friends and family and complaining and saying all this sort of stuff, when really I needed to be talking to a therapist about it. And I think people can kind of blur the lines and be like, oh yeah, I'll just talk to my friend and then I'll feel better about myself for, you know, a day and then it's fine. And I think that's, you know, you have to think about their mental health and you're putting all this stuff onto them, which is, you know, particularly if you have stuff that's quite heavy, it's, yeah, you need to be kind to your friends and family about that stuff too.
Yeah. And when I talk to therapists and counsellors, the other side of that, I think, is one of the most difficult parts of their work, of how do you push enough to encourage the client to make decisions? You know, you're not pushing them towards a particular decision, but you can see when things need changing and when they want to make changes, but maybe they're holding back or they need a bit of extra encouragement, versus you obviously would never want to do that too much and encourage people in a direction that that maybe won't suit them. And, you know, I think that is an impossible ask, really, for friends. And I don't know, this might be a distinctively me experience, but the way you've described that, I've definitely been both the person in the abusive relationship and also the friend who's been hearing about another friend in a relationship like that. And I've definitely seen how both myself and friends of mine have used that as a sort of emotional outlet, that exactly like you sort of described there, that they'll cheer you up, you'll get to kind of vent to a friend about how tough it is, then you'll feel a bit better and then you'll continue with the relationship. And, you know, really, as your friends, no doubt many of them felt, they wanted to support you, but they also wanted to get you out of there. And it can be so difficult, and you may have had so much love for that person and various reasons why it was difficult to leave.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm in this sort of situation at the moment. I've two of my really close friends, one's in an abusive relationship who I've been, you know, trying to help her get out of and to really make it work. But a lot of the time I say, like, you need to do therapy. Like, have you, but not in like, you know, we don't have a conversation. I'm like, you need to do therapy. Like, that's not what I do. I'm trying to be, you know, I'm like, oh, maybe you would, you know, have you ever thought about talking to someone about this, like, professionally? Because I think, like, you know, and then I sort of bring up my history and I'm like, oh yeah, like I went through this and blah, 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 blah. And it made me realize there's a lot of people who are anti-therapy and they just, I don't know if they have a stigma behind it or if it's like they think, you know, they have that image of you lying on a couch and staring at the ceiling and the person's like drawing pictures while they're listening to you. Like, but you know, I've a couple of my friends recently, I've said, oh, I think, you know, maybe therapy is a good, and there's always a block against me. And so now it's kind of like, you know, I'm happy to sort of, you know, speak my truth about therapy and how much it's helped me and stuff. But I think there is a lot of people who just don't want to do it and they should fucking do it. Like, it's one of those things where you're like, you would benefit so much from this. And, you know, and sometimes I almost feel like, because I've done so much therapy, I feel like I know what to say to them to kind of like, you know, oh, maybe you'd like this. And so, you know, I'm like, maybe I should become a psychologist, but no, never in a million years. But they deserve all the money that they get for the job that they do. But yeah, it's frustrating when you, and being in that situation where I was in the toxic relationship and always just venting to my friends, and I knew. And I think the thing is, what in that situation, I did have a counselor. I was doing stuff online because I was always touring. And the person I was speaking to was kind of, I kind of stopped speaking to her a little bit because she was really validating like all the stuff that was going on and what I was thinking. But it was too hard for me to get out of it at that point. So I was like, but I kind of didn't want to hear it. So it's one of those things as well where you need to be open to what a therapist might say. And I think that's what maybe holds people back as well, because they might tell them the truth and say like, oh no, like you need to do this, and they don't want to, or they're scared, maybe scared, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. This can be such fear that, yeah, what will I find out about myself, you know? And if you're feeling already quite overwhelmed, then the idea of potentially finding even more stuff to work on could seem too much. And you're like, okay, I'm just about holding the lid on. I'm just going to keep doing that. And I think it's a very understandable fear. And even me, when I first started going, so I'd had a short term over the phone counselling through a workplace previously, and I would 100% recommend that to anyone because so many workplaces offer it, and mine was really good in that it was confidential. I could contact the external company that were the provider for it, and I didn't have to go to my boss. I'm assuming someone in HR who didn't know me had to probably sign off the payment for it, but that was obviously short term. And so even when it came to me leaving that and knowing I needed more, it partly was starting this show and the work towards starting it that kind of was that tipping point actually for me. I don't think I've shared this before. And so
Yeah, interesting.
I had it in my mind that I needed to go back, and I knew enough about it and enough about sort of mental health more generally that I knew I need something long term and open ended to just really get into it and work on a lot of very deep-rooted stuff. And I think the timeline for when I was going to start, I'd left open-ended as well. And it was always something to come back to. You never quite feel like you have the spare room in your life to do that additional work. And so often it does take a tipping point. And so luckily mine was a positive one in that I knew ahead of starting the show it would be good to make sure I have this additional part of my support network, because I was right in predicting that having a show like this, a lot of things can come up. You know, a guest can say something to you and you're like, oh, wow, that was my experience. What you just said, I related to that too much for it to just be a coincidence. And there was a lot of experiences like that. And so it took, like has happened with me a few times, I'm the same with self-care. It took getting into modelling to really get into a proper self-care routine. And seemingly it took starting a mental health podcast to be like, okay, I should be in therapy before this. I need to be a good role model and make sure I've got my own stuff on the go. Yeah. And I sort of, it's weird to admit that, but I think it's important because it's like, whatever you need to do, however you need to hack your own psychology, You know, if you eat junk food because it's in the house and you don't want to put healthy stuff in the fridge, you'll eat that sooner than you might go to the corner shop. Whatever it is you're working on, there are ways we can use our own silly psychology in a positive
way. Totally. And I think, like, coming off kind of that as well, it's like I think being a comedian, in a sense, like, we're always looking inward. And I'm not sure if I maybe mentioned this to you the other day, but it was when you're writing, and most of the time, like, when you're writing stuff in comedy, you're trying to talk about stuff that is embarrassing. Like, the best stuff, the best comedy, the best jokes, the best anything comes from stuff that you're embarrassed to really talk about, that maybe you've done. Or I think even in terms of my most popular bits have always been stuff that I've been, you know, scared to talk about, or, you know, embarrassed about a little bit. But you mine yourself so much. So in a sense, it's kind of like, I was talking to someone the other day and they're like, you know, a comedian is almost more like intuitive on their mental health and their behavior, because we are constantly like looking inside, we're writing about it. We're like, why do I do this? Why do I do that? Like, we question everything about ourselves. I mean, there is a lot of comedians who talk about therapy and talk about mental health. I think in the past few years, it is a very common thing. And I think it's great, because I think as comedians, like, we do have to make people think. And the same with people who live, like, you know, with a podcast as well, it's like we're listening to this for help, because maybe we're not thinking about things in this kind of way. And, you know, I always strive to craft really well, like, comedy that makes people think, that makes them go home and be like, yeah, she was saying that and I kind of feel the same way. What? We all, you know, deal with our mental health and cope with it in some way. Some people like to bury it deep, 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 deep down, and others, you know, maybe like ourselves, who like to really look at it and kind of question why we're doing these things and our behaviours.
And to bring up an example of another Australian comic who I think speaks on a lot of this really well, I'm assuming you've seen Nanette Hannah Gadsby's special.
I saw it twice in Edinburgh, Nanette, and I saw her show in Douglas in Seattle in 2019. So I've seen her, and obviously growing up in Australia, I've watched her for years. So she's very, very, very clever.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things in particular you've reminded me of that I'd love your perspective on is she talks about this idea of how in comedy you can get caught trying to find the funny in traumatic situations as opposed to the solution, because so often that is the more obvious way to make the joke. And a lot of trauma, you can't make a joke about telling the full story in an authentic way with the emotions that match it. And so sometimes you have to kind of flip it or twist the story in order to find the humour there. And is that something you find yourself having to navigate, of talking about things that are vulnerable and keeping the vulnerability and the honesty, but also the pressure to be funny?
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the past, I've always just kind of defaulted to the funny. And I think Hannah Gadsby with Nanette has really sort of changed the way that we do look at standard comedy. And I mean, that's a whole argument in itself, because, you know, internet trolls, male comedians who just don't even consider that comedy at all. And there's a whole debate around that, which I'm not going to go into because I'll get very heated about it and stuff. But for me, I was always trying to find the funny. And that also came from my mum, because we grew up with so much trauma and tragedy in my family. So my mum was always like, oh, don't be, like, I remember doing a cabaret show years ago, sort of my first kind of proper solo show. And I was talking about having anorexia and talking about, you know, just not eating and all this sort of stuff. And I remember my mum came up to me after the show and she was like, oh, just all that sad stuff, just forget about it. Just get rid of all the sad stuff and just make people laugh. People just want to be fun. Just be funny. Just make them laugh. And I think after that, I sort of felt a bit embarrassed about talking about my mental health issues and stuff. And so I always just defaulted to the funny. I was like, oh, just, you know, don't worry. People just want to laugh. They want to come out and have a good time. And I particularly did that in the last few years with a lot of my dating stories. And I mean, a lot of the dating stories that I've told on stage, like, a lot of those times, sometimes I was scared. I was like fearful that something would happen. But I did talk about it in a way that was kind of like, haha, funny, 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 light, light, light. Oh, yeah, like, then we had sex and fine, like, whatever. But in reality, there was a lot of, you know, kind of fear, which I didn't talk about, and I was too scared to talk about that. And I think it's also, people sometimes don't want to hear that. But in my last show, the show that I'm touring at the moment, Dirty, which is, it's about being in an abusive relationship. And I've really found a way to kind of still talk about that really openly and how I was the victim of coercive control and being manipulated and controlled, but still being able to find a happy ending in a sense. So it's a lot of weaving and it's kind of a lot of trial and error. You know, having said that, it ends on a high, everyone has a great time. But I still, after the show, I've had people come up to me and be like, I was in an abusive relationship as well and I understand. And like, you know, and that has been really validating to kind of go, well, no, you can be funny, but also make people think about being in those kind of situations, whether you be the toxic person or the person who's being abused. It's kind of like, you know, I hope both parties can kind of go, oh, was I that person? Or, you know, like, was that an abusive relationship? So yeah, it's difficult to find the balance and to find the funny in it. And, but yeah, there's ways to do it. And I think it took me a while, but I finally got there in the end. So it works now, but yeah, it's always a constant struggle.
And that just sounds really magical to me to hear that people are able to relate to you in what sounds like a broader way, and surely very validating to be like, oh, okay, these things that I thought would be a conflict to my comedy actually can be an additional way that people can relate to me. They can relate on the ha-has and then they can relate on the message. And that's something that, getting to work with a lot of comedians, that's sort of something I feel quite protective at times over people on, that I would hate any of you to feel that your platform and your voice and influence was conditional on you always have to be funny. Like, you can only speak your truth as long as there's always a punchline. I don't think that's good for anybody, you know, in the same way we talk about the show, you know, demonizing certain emotions is so dangerous. And so to equally go the other way and be like, okay, I can only focus on this one emotion seems like a different version of the same thing, and potentially such a conflict to doing therapy and working on yourself and getting more insightful and getting used to maybe talking about your experiences with a certain level of emotional depth, to then be like, okay, but now we got to pull right up and make it all funny and make it all silly, these things that are actually potentially very sad.
True. It's a difficult thing to do, but I think you want those people to go home from the show, because I think, like, if you think about something that has really stayed with you that you've seen from a comedy show, like, you're not really going to remember all the shitty little dick jokes or like whatever. Like, for me, I don't really remember that. But of course, Nanette sticks out in your mind because it breaks the mold in so many ways. And it's talking about, you know, sexual abuse and rape and all these like really intense things in a way that is very confrontational. And I think, you know, I walked away from seeing that. I saw it live twice in Edinburgh. I had to see it again. Like, I saw it once and I was like, oh my God. And then I went and saw it again. I brought a guy that I was dating. I was like, we need to go and see this show. And it was one of those things where I wanted everyone to see it, because in particular guys that I dated, I'm like, or my dad or my brother, I was like, you need to go and see this. And it just put it in a way that you would hope would make them think and kind of go, oh, like my behaviors. And I think that's like, you know, I think that's way more clever than just, you know, watching maybe a male stand up on stage talking about how he's watched porn. Like to me, I'm like, oh yeah, cool, like whatever. But you do want that stuff that makes you think and that can maybe change a behavior or make someone feel better. And you know, that's always what I guess I strive for now. Like, you know, using Hannah as such a, like an icon and such an inspiration to my writing, and the fact that she's also Australian is like, you know, I'm like, oh yeah, she's Australian, it's so good. Yeah, I think that's really important that people still walk away and have a good time. Like, that's my kind of thing. Like, they walk away, like I don't leave them, you know, like what Hannah does in the net. Like, it's a lot more kind of lighter, but still it's important, I
think. Yeah, that's wonderful to hear. I'm very proud of you hearing that.
Oh, thanks. You have to come and see the show.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, well, you tour all over the place, so I'm sure you'll be to Dublin at some point.
Again, yeah, it's true.
It's just so great to hear that you're finding that place with it, because it's such an ongoing process finding what our truth is. And I think that's been one of the most uncomfortable things for me to go through therapy on. And so one of the things that's been challenging through all of that is finding out, okay, who you are and what your truth is and what your story is. And even having a show like this, it's so strange because it's so documented. Like, I can listen back to old episodes and hear myself speak in a very vulnerable way and actually be quite proud of myself for being like, oh, that was 2 years ago and you were speaking about that, that's good. Yeah, like proud of a younger me. It's a weird time warp thing. It's very meta. But also you hear things of, oh, actually, I don't talk about that in quite the same way. I've realized that there's an even truer truth. And I don't know if you've had this in therapy where sometimes you find out even more about yourself and it contradicts the story that you've been telling or the version of you that you thought you were. And that's been one of the biggest things for me, of really embracing that evolution of, okay, how can I keep finding out more about what I need to work on and finding a more honest way to see my experiences that's even closer to the emotional truth, and then that not be too uncomfortable and me not pull back and be like, no, I know it already.
No, absolutely. I think that's really interesting as well, like, you know, for you to like listen back and kind of go, oh, I have grown, like that's an amazing thing. And I think that just shows how much you are working on yourself, and you know, and through therapy, it's just that thing we were talking about earlier about like acceptance and awareness of behavioral stuff. And for me, it's like, you know, I went through anorexia for like 8 years. Like, it was always around me in terms of like, got to be skinny and you've got to be like this and this sort of stuff. And I'm like, I'm really out of it now. And it's so great because I don't have the same issues and the same anxiety about food and stuff as I once did. Like, it's always still there, but it's one of those things where I, like, you know, there was a real moment of when I was living in France this year, which would have absolutely sent me if I had been there about 5 years ago, because there's so much cheese, so much bread, like butter and like all this sort of stuff. But now I like this year, I just found myself enjoying it. And I was like, no, you're at a point where you're so healthy, so it's not going to be this huge issue that it once was. And it was like that moment where and maybe that's something we can like definitely take out of today's like talk, is just to be proud of yourself and like, and look back over like how maybe you may have reacted or maybe how you would have behaved in the past and go like, oh no, I wouldn't do that now. And I think especially now we just have to be so kind to ourselves and just really like be proud of the little things in our lives, because I think we're all evolving. We're constantly evolving. That's what we are as humans. So, and that also comes out of doing the work and the therapy and you know, that awareness and acceptance of your own mental health at the end of the day.
I agree with all of that. And it is, it's a difficult process going through therapy, and sometimes it feels a lot easier or more difficult than others. And yet, you're right, it is so worth it. And I do feel so much more like myself now, which feels like a strange thing to say out loud, but that is the best way I've got to say it, because, you know, life is short and humans are complex. And I guess that's what I was maybe getting at earlier, that I've had to learn it's enough to get closer to the truth and the answers about who you are and what, you know, what chance at different levels of happiness any of us can get. And, you know, striving for that is the progress as opposed to reaching any kind of end goal.
Oh, totally. And I think just on that, like, two things. Like, I think for me, I stopped looking at like happiness as like, you know, it's like the pursuit of happiness, which for me is like, I don't, you know, happiness is comes and goes, but it's like just being content in life. And for me, it's like, I just want to get, I'm so content in my life now because I've accepted that, you know, there is no happiness, like there is no like, you know, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that we're going to reach and then suddenly life is going to be great. Like, I'll have good weeks and I'll have bad weeks. But, you know, I think on that, it's, you know, therapy alone isn't everything. I changed my diet. I changed my lifestyle. I meditate now every day. I journal every day. I write like gratitude stuff, which to me, like 5 years ago, I'd be like, ew, like, what the fuck is she doing? Like, writing a gratitude. But all these little things, along with therapy, along with just a different outlook on stuff, just makes all of the difference. And, you know, I hate sounding sometimes like a like an influencer or something, like, oh my God, you gotta do this, this is amazing. But like, it does work. And I think there is a way, you know, to do it that doesn't sound wanky. But I think if you eat well and you exercise and you look after your health and you look after your body and your mind. And I think in terms of like your stomach health and digestion is so related to mental health. And I realized that as well. For many years, I went through a lot of health issues and stuff because of anorexia, but I kind of got to a point where it was like, oh no, if I look after my physical health and my gut health and the way that I eat, that also affects my mind as well. And I think it's, yeah, not just like a one thing of like, do therapy, that's going to fix you. It's like, it's everything to do with self-work and just taking care of your body and your life as a whole.
Yeah, for sure. And I remember my counsellor once explained it to me as almost like another way of seeing going to counselling every week is that you could see it as like the start and end point of the session, or you could see the sessions as being the start and the end point is the next one. And all the work that you do outside in the real world is really what that hour is about. And I think that's a really important way of looking at it. You know, that you're right, there's so much work we have to do, and it's, you could be a wonderful client in many ways in the room, but you also need to be doing the work and making whatever changes you need to, living a broadly healthy life in a lot of ways.
Definitely. So yeah,
no, good point to end on. Thank you. And so definitely, if people are related to your experience and want to see, I guess, more of you, whether that's talking about this, whether it's going and seeing your comedy, where can they find you online?
Yeah, of course. You can find me on Instagram. I'm very active on there, at Elena Gabrielle. Also, you can watch some comedy if you're having a bad day. That's also been a lot of, through the last year, I've had a lot of people just watch my videos to make them feel better. So you can do that on YouTube. Just search Elena Gabrielle, stand-up or comedian. Yeah, I have a website as well. I'm on tour next year, 2022, doing shows across Europe and Canada and Australia. So you can check that out on my website or Instagram as well. But yeah, drop me a line if you feel like you can relate in some point, because I'm always happy to talk about mental health in any way.
Brilliant. And I will personally plug as well that you've been on my other podcast, Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast, twice now. Once yes. for each season.
Yes.
And so the link for that will be in the episode description if people want to check out your appearances on there and hear you tell some really great dating stories.
Amazing.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.